As we wrap up the year, I'm humbled by the outpouring of support I've received from all of you since starting this podcast. My original goal was simple: record conversations with industry leaders and share their stories and the lessons they have learned with others. The idea was born not out of a desire to be a podcast host, but rather an opportunity to help educate my colleagues and industry peers. This has proven to be a very effective tool, and each email or LinkedIn post I receive from you motivates and reinforces the importance of building community and sharing knowledge. I've heard that some of the snippets from the podcast episodes have been used to help teams learn about the market, to help capital raisers raise money, and to help investors write investment committee memos. Most importantly, these episodes are to help you learn about the journey of private markets leaders, their companies, and what they see as the greatest challenges and opportunities ahead. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. Juniper Square is the leading provider of technology and third-party administration to private markets GPs and is trusted by more than 2,100 GPs across real estate, private equity, private credit, infrastructure, venture capital, crypto, and more. To learn more about Juniper Square, you can drop me an email at brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com or visit junipersquare.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends and colleagues and be sure to follow the episodes on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and subscribe via YouTube. I've got some great episodes in store for 2025 and I greatly appreciate your continued support. Let's get into it.
We have an exclusive focus on registered investment advisors. So RIAs is the acronym. RIAs, you know, unlike the old days of investment advisor, the Smith Barney, where they were buying stocks and charging you commissions, they're fiduciaries. So they're looking out for their clients first. They typically get paid whatever their fee is, basis points, could be 100 basis, whatever that is, on the assets under management. So if assets go up and they perform well, they get paid. If they go down, so there's a true alignment. We're not focused on the institutions, the pensions, the endowments, and the like, not for any specific reason, outside of we relate more to those RIAs. We host 6 to 8 real estate symposiums in our home office where it's classroom style. We'll have them in, you know, the night before for dinner, meet, you know, I always say, welcome to our home. I want them to meet our accounts. I want them to really understand our DNA, who we are and what we stand for.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square, where I sit down with leaders across private markets. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Darren Fisk, founder and CEO of Forum, a national multifamily real estate investment manager focused exclusively on raising capital from RIAs and the private wealth channel. On today's episode, Darren and I discuss his entrepreneurial journey and focus on building a durable business, his early decision to focus on wealth advisors and RIAs before private wealth was in the news, and what being in the NFL taught him about business and life. I enjoyed my conversation with Darren and know you will too. Let's get into it. Darren, welcome to the show.
Brandon, thanks for having me.
For our listeners that aren't familiar with who you are or your firm, can you take a second and please just introduce yourself and your company, please?
Sure, yeah. Darren Fisk, I'm the founder and CEO of Forum Investment Group, or better known as Forum. Forum is a multifamily-only investment manager. We do three things up and down the capital stack. We invest in debt in a strategy, we have private credit in a strategy, and then we have an equity vehicle as a strategy. And then we do one-off developments, one soon to be in your hometown of San Diego.
I love it. We're looking forward to having more housing in San Diego. Thank you. So before we get into the multifamily market and details about Forum, I always like to start these conversations with you. Let's learn a little bit more about, you know, where did you grow up? You know, what was your journey into commercial real estate?
Yeah, grew up in Los Gatos, California, before the tech boom happened. My dad was an elementary school principal. Mom was an interior decorator. You know, kind of just like any kid, I was surfing and skateboarding and playing soccer and football. And my folks would buy single family homes and duplexes and triplexes from the time I was little till I left for college. And I ended up being our handyman. So I learned kind of the traits of framing and wiring of electrical and hanging drywall and irrigation and, you know, laying sod and building decks and fences. So had one sister. As I mentioned, you know, the Bay Area is a lot different now. When I left for Boulder in 1992, it's right when the tech boom happened. I dated this girl. Her dad was a CFO of an up-and-coming called Intel, and I had never heard of it at the time. So obviously a lot's changed since I left. Been in Denver for the most part since 1992. And yeah, just, you know, kind of grew up in this blue, kind of grayish collar family in the Bay Area, and learned, you know, to be an entrepreneur just through my mom and the different businesses that she was in.
So 1992, you ship off to Colorado. I think you went to CU, is that right?
I did. Actually, sight unseen, and maybe some of the story of my life, I like change. And so I had toured a couple of the colleges in California, had a pretty decent football career, you know, in high school, and got invited to the state all-star game, and everybody thought I was too small. So I literally didn't have one scholarship offer. So I ended up just going to Boulder, sight unseen, like I mentioned. Had been to Durango, Colorado in sixth grade to a dude ranch, and came out the week before school started, registered for classes, and the rest is history.
So let's talk about football, because I know that was a part of your early career. You played in high school, you played in college, right? And then you played in the NFL. So let's, how does the football journey tie into your professional journey?
So lots of lessons learned. Probably started in high school. Butch Catalco was our high school football coach, but I was a middle linebacker. I was our fullback, and I was also our punter. You can imagine, you know, going out there with the big neck rolls. I actually came to Colorado, and having not received any offers, I joined a fraternity my freshman year, and it was during this freshman, you know, pledge football that one night we were at a fraternity party about midnight, and this guy, Dave, approached me. He's like, "You think you could ever play football here?" I said, "Yeah." And so he bet me $100. So the next day I walked up to the athletic department, asked for the defensive coordinator. He wasn't in. The linebacker coach was in, Brian Cabral. He said, "Hey, we remember recruiting you, thought you were too small, and said, if you come out and you're here all summer, love to have you, you know, come on." So I basically walked on to the football team, got a scholarship, and started as a linebacker, and then converted to fullback as well. Did a little bit of both while I was at Colorado.
Wow, that's incredible. What a great story. And so while you were at Colorado, I mean, what were your interests? I mean, did you know that you were going to go on to have a career in, you know, commercial real estate, or kind of what were you thinking at that time, if you can remember back then?
I do remember. I remember I didn't know the difference between accounting and finance when I first took those two courses. And I learned quickly that I didn't like accounting and I loved real estate and finance. So that really shaped, you know, kind of, I got a bachelor's in real estate finance and a minor in small business management. But interestingly enough, during the summers while we were training for football, I would hire some of my football buddies to earn extra money, and we'd go do decks and fences and landscaping and the like. So I was always like wanted to work. That was just like, I was kind of just that workhorse. And I wasn't given, you know, the 6'3 build. I'm just under, you know, 6'2. And, you know, I had to outwork everybody, especially as a walk-on. And that's kind of one of the things in my DNA is, you know, you can only get so far outworking people. You have to sometimes outsmart folks as you get older. You know, there's only 24 hours in the day. So lots of lessons learned about leadership, about adversity, like who are your teammates and who are your partners when times get tough? When times are easy, you know, it's easy street. And it's when times are tough that you see people's true colors. So learned a lot about teamwork, not an individual sport, but a team sport, and how that translates into the business world as well.
So you graduated from Colorado. What was your next move? Did you start for him then, or did you have kind of a career before you got onto the entrepreneurial founder journey of starting for him?
Yeah, I actually was a free agent with the Atlanta Falcons. I tell people my careers aren't measured in decimal points, but went with the Falcons. I was our third string fullback. They cut the second string guy, move up to number two. And then I actually blew up my neck in the middle of training camp. And so that was the end of the career. I went back to the Bay Area to see, you know, what they could do. And there is no fixing a bad neck. Then, like most folks, I was kind of searching, you know, like, what am I going to do? I had no idea what I was going to do in life. I started working for a software company that worked with NFL and college football teams. And I was tiling bathrooms and buying homes, I should say, buying homes and you know, fixing them up and, you know, renting them out and selling them. And I was tiling this bathroom one night at like 10 p.m. and I'm sitting there going, what am I doing? Like, I football career's over. I had, you know, a taste, you know, with the Falcons. And it wasn't a good taste. It was just a different experience. It wasn't like you're playing for your school and your friends. It was really a job and lost kind of the fun anyways. But that's when I said, you know, I really want to get back into real estate. You know, having grown up, as I mentioned earlier, you know, fixing, you know, homes and doing that stuff, I just knew I didn't want to be a contractor. And I realized the best way to learn real estate, having talked to a bunch of different real estate experts, was if you understand how the financials of real estate transactions go together, you can hire the developers, you can hire the property managers, you can hire the general contractors, but you got to really understand the fundamentals, the financials, if you will. And so I started off in the real estate finance business with a company here in Denver called Johnson Capital. We had 17 offices. And so got in through the finance side. And that's really what launched my real estate career.
So let's go back to the time in the NFL. I know you say it was short and sweet, but how long were you in the NFL? And were you with the Falcons the entire time that you were there?
Yeah, I was with the Falcons the entire time. Really just through the fourth game of training camp, I hurt my neck the second game, came back in the third. And, you know, I had hopes that I could fix it, and there just was no fixing it. So I didn't even make it to the regular season, unfortunately, or maybe it was fortunately, that still have a neck. But I was losing my vision for about 30 minutes at a time when I would get hit from the right side of my neck. And, you know, look back, it's like, well, thank God I didn't have many strokes, but just wasn't getting enough blood into my head. I was pinching an artery in the left side of my neck.
Wow. That's terrifying. Well,
I met some great people, though. It was a great experience. You got an inside look, and it made a lot of great friends from connections through that as well.
Well, yeah, and I want to come back to that because, you know, I think we'll maybe get there in the evolution of Forum, but it seems to me as a, you know, having known the business for probably seven, eight years now, a lot of your initial network, some of your relationships, I know we were just talking before we started recording, your personal friends are NFL players. So while you weren't in the NFL for that long, it seems pretty clear that it was a big part of your life or has been a big part of football and the connections you made. Kind of how did you make some of those connections and have them tie from your sports world to your professional world?
So good friend of mine, actually the best man at my wedding, was a guy named Tim Dwight. We were rookies together in Atlanta and, you know, just an extremely hard worker, you know. If you guys remember Tim, he was one of the fastest guys in the NFL, kickoff returner, punt returner, wide receiver. You know, that kid had no fear, but he had the work ethic like I did. And just through following and supporting him and just other folks that I had met, you know, kind of just went on to, you know, Drew Brees, met him through Tim in San Diego at a Halloween party. And Drew is one of our original investors 20 plus years ago. And kind of joke around that I used to call him on Sundays and he'd never answer. And I'd tell him to call me back. And he, you know, on Monday reminded me that he has a job on Sundays playing in the NFL. So it was just one of those things where I love to play the game. I love to play sports, but I don't really follow sports. But while I was first raising money for our first 252 unit acquisition in 2003, Drew and a few of the guys, Tim and a few of the other folks, you know, started investing with us, just like my mom and dad that put $25,000 in our first acquisition. And, you know, it's that old saying, you know, you do well or good news travels fast, bad news travels faster. And so I was very cognizant to make sure that we didn't have bad investments or bad deals.
Yeah, I think, there's a really consistent theme throughout a lot of the conversations I have, which is the power of relationships. So I'm sure we'll come back to that. It sounds like it's a big part of your story as well.
Yeah. Travel in wide circles.
That's right. I love it. So Johnson Capital, real estate finance, how long were you there? And then kind of when did you decide it was time to move on? And what was your next step from there?
So I was there about 10 years, my partner, Guy Johnson, and then Mike Cantwell in the Denver office. And so I had fortunately got in. Denver was the home to a lot of real estate REITs. So UDR, which is still here, AIMCO. We had Black Creek, which then became Dividend Capital. And then we also had Archstone, another one here. So I actually got in with AIMCO and a few of these REITs. So I was financing things for the mom and pops all the way up to the REITs. The REITs assumed that you already knew everything. the mom and pops didn't know anything. And so the learning that I got in the business and real estate finance, I learned a lot more in the weeds, if you will, from the mom and pops that I was financing for than I did, you know, from the REITs, because again, attorneys are on the phone. Now, I did learn a lot about the institutional world that I am now in today, but at the time, there probably couldn't be better lessons learned than having to know your stuff for the mom and pops. And I took a liking, Brandon, really to multifamily finance. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, HUD, you know, we have twice as many lenders in multifamily than we do in commercial. And just housing, community, just things that defined me that I really loved about the multifamily space.
I always like to talk about stories or examples. If you think about, are there any defining moments or stories you can remember from working with the mom and pops about, like, you know, this idea that, wow, you know, there's a lot of education required, but also a lot of power in the kind of individual investor kind of landlord model?
Yeah. So, you know, when you're dealing with the mom and pops, they were typically smaller size, you know, 50 units or less versus more of the institutional grades, usually 150, 200 units or more. You know, the thing was, like, really learning from them, you know, they were the property manager and they weren't at times like taking a property management fee. So as I'm looking at this, it's like, well, where's the property management fee? Where are your maintenance reserves? And then I'm working with lenders and they're asking the same questions. So it's almost like I was educating them. I said, hey, you need to start taking these fees, you know, to show a true value of this when you ever get ready to either refinance these things or sell them. And so it was literally like building from the ground up versus when we were financing stuff for, say, the bigger apartment REITs or institutional owners, all those line items and then some were in there. And so really scrubbing down these financials for these folks was probably the biggest lesson that I learned, but I was also able to teach them as well on the learning side, where they started going from, say, 25 or 50 units up into 100, 200 unit projects. So I grew with them.
So at some point, you decided to move on. What kind of gave you the confidence or what triggered you to leave that role and, I'm guessing, start Forum at the time, correct?
Correct. And you know, I look back and I probably shouldn't say this for all the mortgage bankers that were out there, but I couldn't believe how much we were getting paid in fee revenue, you know, to do these loans, whether it was a, you know, $100 million loan or a $10 million loan. It was typically, you know, it did scale down as you got bigger, but we were paid a lot. And I'll never forget in 2007, we were officing downtown Denver and I had this check and I kept looking at it. And I remember I would walk across the street to the Wells Fargo branch to deposit it. And I said, I'm never going to have a bigger commission than this in my career. Like, I can't believe it. And then obviously, you know, it was too good to be true. I also was wondering, I said, at what point would I ever transition from lending into owning? Because remember, I mentioned in 2003, one of my finance clients and I, we bought 252 units in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I'm taking you guys back a little bit in time here. And a year into it, we refinanced and pulled 125% of our money out. And I said, wow, this is kind of a racket. How do we do more of this? So that partner and I had bought about 3,500 apartment units together from 2003 leading up to the GFC, the Great Financial Crisis in 2008. And all of a sudden, the market just fell off a cliff. And, you know, I needed the income, right? I was only as good as my last, you know, commission through, you know, financing. And I had two clients up in Boulder, Colorado, and one was a single family home builder. The other was a developer. They got in trouble like many did. And my partner up there, now at the time partner, Lou, said to me, he's like, Darren, look, Jim's in trouble. He's a single family home builder. Think he's going to file bankruptcy. I don't think we can, you know, do this 240 unit development in Boulder. And all I thought was, hey, I need this commission. So I thought about it for a couple of days. I said, Lou, I've got a proposal. If you get this entitled, I will get it built. And he said, well, what do you know about, you know, building apartments? I said, well, my father-in-law is a retail developer. I'm sure I'll find the right team to help put this together. So you fast forward, We actually ended up breaking ground on 240 units in Boulder in 2009, right in the middle of the GFC. And we had a 40-year non-recourse loan from HUD. Nothing in Boulder, over 50 units had been built in 25 years. We were right in the middle of the 29th Street Mall, which is about a million square foot lifestyle center owned by Macerich. And we built it. It was, you know, a phenomenal transaction. Nobody else was building at the time. And that's really what kicked off my transition, if you will, into the real estate principal side of the business, not just the real estate finance. And don't get me wrong, I was still financing properties up until about 2014. We actually sold Johnson Capital, and it just naturally kind of transitioned. But I always had in the back of my mind, when am I going to be able to ever make that pivot into just owning and operating real estate versus financing? But hey, I had a finance team. We were still getting these great commissions, and I was using that to invest in all these deals that we started buying and were building. And just one last point, we also bought 9,000 units from 2009 to 2012 while we started these developments. So we were fast and furious, as quick as we could go, syndicating, you know, from folks that I met at the gym, from folks that I met through the NFL and their friends. And that's really how it finally transitioned. And then we ended up selling Johnson Capital. So it was kind of just an easy transition.
So I want to get this right. So your first kind of real development deal was the Boulder deal that you just mentioned. That was in 2009, right? And then prior to that, your first like real multifamily deal was the Albuquerque deal. And was that 2007 or 2003?
That was 2003.
Three, yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So you kind of like legged into your entrepreneurial journey kind of very deliberately, and maybe it didn't seem deliberate at the time, but opportunistically is maybe the right word. As you were kind of going through this, you know, between 2003 when the market's ripping, 2009, you know, not quite ripping any longer, kind of, were you pretty consistent in your belief that there was something here, or were there periods where you maybe were less convicted? Like, how did the development of, you know, the desire to start your own thing full time kind of rip the Band-Aid off happen?
You know, like I said, it was more of an evolution. You know, after we started that first deal in Boulder, I mentioned the 204 units, my phone started ringing, and we actually broke ground on 200-300 unit additional developments in Denver. So imagine 2009 and 10, we have three 300 unit-ish developments under construction, and people thought I had lost my mind or too many concussions or maybe a combination of both. And all I knew, and it's easy to make up a story looking back, how smart, it was more of, wait a minute, nothing in Boulder had been built over 50 units in 25 years. These two locations in Denver were, if I told you the location, Denver, you'd say, wow, how'd you get your hands on those? And then that's what actually took us to Minnesota, where we started doing developments in Minnesota. Somebody was in trouble. It was kind of the same playbook, just a different market. And we just saw opportunity, Brandon, more than anything. But again, after I deposited that check at Wells Fargo and we weren't receiving, I mean, I had no finance income. I mean, we weren't financing anything. The markets were just in a free fall. And so one of the things that started were we had development fees, you know, as we were doing these developments. So that helped me. I was single or actually freshly married in the GFC. And so didn't have a lot to lose either at the time. And so right place, right time. And one of the things that I'll mention also is one of my investment philosophies. It's always been about cash flow. And my father-in-law always has, his name is Dick Landon. I call him the Dickisms. He has these sayings because he's been through more cycles and what have you, but just an awesome guy. He said, Darren, if there's one thing in life you remember, remember this. It's like, okay, don't touch your daughter or your, what is it? And he said, cash is king, but cash flow's queen. Wake up next to the queen the rest of your life and you're going to be a happy man. And what happened with that first deal in Albuquerque was the cash flow's queen. Like, all of a sudden, I had a check coming in. I didn't have to go do another real estate finance deal to make another commission that was gone. And so my whole investment philosophy was, well, how much cash flow can I, you know, continue to build up over the years? And that, you know, has helped my investment philosophy even today.
I love that. I love the Dickisms. So day one for Forum, when was that? What did Forum look like? What did day one look like for you? What were you doing? What was your focus? Yeah, talk to us a bit about the journey.
Day one, it was really two guys in a truck, as I said, because I drove a Dodge diesel truck. And it was really myself and my two real estate finance analysts. I hired a development manager, really an owner's rep, if you will, to help with that project in Boulder. When the next 300-unit development opportunity in Denver came, the gentleman that brought it to me said, hey, I got to close quickly. I've got a real tax issue. We're going to do this big condo project. And I met with him. I said, look, Mark, I'll do this with you, but I need your head of development to come with this opportunity. So Kevin Foltz, who ran our development, now is now our president. I brought on some expertise to help build the development side while we, you know, slowly started, you know, slowly is our acquisition side as well. So started, you know, like I said, two guys in a truck with an LLC and a logo and an operating agreement for, you know, these one-off developments and then acquisitions, and then started hiring, you know, along the way. And if there was one thing that I, if I could ever write a book, I would call it Lessons Learned, because nobody was ever there to tell me as an entrepreneur what to go do. I wish there were people that had said, hey, watch out for this or don't do that, because people are going to figure out their way, what to go do. But I've got a great friend in Denver here. He's 10 years younger than me and a lot more energy now and the like, but just wanting to kill the world. And he's doing it. One of the largest developers here in Cherry Creek. And I say, Matt, I just want to teach you what not to do. And so like after the GFC in 08, you know, watching people lose everything, single family home builders, I said, you know, I want to build a sustainable company that I can invest throughout real estate cycles, not to a real estate cycle. So what does that mean? When the market for real estate shuts off, say for acquisitions, doesn't matter whether it's office or retail or hotel, it usually shuts off for all property types, like in the GFC. When development shuts off, higher interest rates, nobody's immune to that shutting off. And again, the lesson learned after 08 and you know, seeing these bankruptcies and people get in trouble was, I want to be able to invest throughout these cycles. So hence, Forum has, I mentioned at the beginning, you know, three investment strategies. We have debt, we have private credit, we have equity. If we didn't have our debt and private credit vehicles right now, I don't know what I would be doing. Because acquisitions, like the only reason why you would sell today is if you have to sell. Developments, for the most part, don't pencil in the multifamily space. And so we've just been doing debt, and more debt. You know, we're getting equity returns in debt. So those lessons learned through different real estate cycles, everybody needs to take note and look back and say, hey, what did I learn? Like, what did 08 teach me? What did COVID teach me? You know, what did higher interest rates teach me? And try, you know, most real estate guys are all about the next deal. I was about the next deal. Almost the first two-thirds of my career was like, well, where's the next deal? I always say it's like Fred Flintstone in Rock Vegas. His eyes are straight. He's like, bet. Like, you know, slot machines are going off and everybody's winning money. And that comes to an end. And I made a decision approximately 10 years ago that I had to build a business. I couldn't just be like a tree with a bunch of limbs and no roots. I had to have roots in the ground and build a foundation so that no matter how many limbs I had on that tree wasn't going to fall over. So that foundation was crucial. And it was hard. Hard as an entrepreneur to stop and hit the pause button and build, you know, an investment management business on top of a real estate company.
I think it's fascinating. I talk, you know, for people who listen to the podcast and read what I put out on LinkedIn, I talk a lot about this idea of building enterprise value, building a durable business. For the reason you just stated, so many people set off because they love transacting, they love doing deals, and it's so easy to get caught up in that. What's interesting about your story is you specifically paused and you said, 10 years ago, I made a decision. How did you get off the, like, all I want to do is deals to wait? I actually have to build something. You obviously know it's important with the benefit of hindsight, but was there kind of something that triggered you to make this deliberate transition to focusing on building an investment management business that's durable, that has value?
There were quite a few factors and alarms going off in my head. One major thing was, and I'll give an analogy, was on the hiring front. Like, how am I ever going to attract the best talent? And in different phases of business, from two guys in a truck to 75 people that we have now here in Denver, Colorado, and my analogy is, it's like the guys that played on my high school football team with me, those, that was like my infancy and my first phase of Forum. And then all of a sudden, you know, maybe 3 to 5 of my high school buddies went, you know, on to play college at different levels. That was kind of Forum 2.0. That's having development, that's having acquisitions. And today we're in the NFL, and very few folks, probably 1 or 2 of my high school buddies, would have made it, you know, to the NFL. And so the learning lessons, again, is this evolution. When I knew that I had to solve for me, I had to solve for a legacy business. When I say a legacy, not about my legacy, but about attracting the talent that I have today. I'll give you an example. Jay Miller, our CIO. Jay joined us about 2 years ago. He was the global chief investment officer of Deutsche Bank's real estate arm. It was called REEF, REEF. And he ran a $25 billion global real estate fund for 15 years. The high school football team could never attract a Jay Miller. The college football team could not attract a Jay Miller. Our CFO, Paul McAuliffe. Paul was the CFO of AIMCO, the largest apartment REIT, you know, that was one of my clients, took him public. Like, the college and high school football teams could not attract that talent. So I knew that I had to upgrade the talent. I had to build a sustainable business, and it had to be able to run without me. I always say, I want to be wanted, not needed. Right now, I've gotten to that point where it's like, I still want to be needed, but I'm definitely wanted, but not needed in the level of my business. And it's a conscious decision. There are a lot of successful real estate firms that continue to do deal by deal, and they're just opportunistic, and they have a different. And I just saw that I had to build something that was lasting, you know, that book Built to Last. But I also saw a lot of things changing in the market where, through different downturns, you know, Brandon, like the lending business, banks, there's 71% fewer banks today than there were in 1980. 7-1, okay? Yeah. Before the GFC, you know, I was doing financing with Washington Mutual, WaMu, Wachovia, right? They're not around anymore. They were doing these 80 and 90% non-recourse loans. I say, well, what could go wrong? Today, if you're lucky on a construction loan, you're getting 50 to 55% leverage. On top of, construction costs over the last decade have more than doubled. So your capital stack and the need to raise, instead of me needing $3.3 million like I did in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 2003, today I need $33 million on average for an acquisition. Lower leverage, higher costs. And so all those data points were kind of swirling around my head. And I always ask people when I interview them, you know, what's your genius? And they look at me like, I think I know what you mean. And it's really like, what are you world-class at? Like, for me, I'm world-class at connecting the dots. Like, that's what I'm really, and relationships. I love people. I love relationships. But kind of seeing where things are going, always like my mind's going in a loop. And if it doesn't connect, I got to stop and fix that. And then it, like, and so it's just seeing all these data points about where the market was going. And how did I build a company that was lasting where I could attract that kind of talent?
I'm smiling. For those who are listening, you can't see me, but one of my mentors, Steve LeBlanc, who used to run Texas Teachers and is kind of a legend in the real estate space, asked me that same question and was really a major kind of catalyst of a career switch for me. He said, we were on a bus ride at an Urban Land Institute meeting, and he said to me, he said, Brandon, what's your personal genius? And exactly as you said, I looked at him like he was crazy, and it took me a little while to figure it out. But eventually, getting very clear on the things you're good at and the things you're not so good at and the things you love and that you don't love is super helpful. So I'm glad. Thank you for sharing that with us. That's great to hear. when you think about Forum today, so 10 years ago, you started this journey to build a business. Give us the headlines. You know, you talked about the different ways that you invest. How many people do you have? What markets are you in? Units that you have under management or advisement or whatever kind of stats that you quote from a top line perspective.
Sure. So again, you know, the evolution, you know, to get the lessons learned. I mean, it's a grind. And I have a life saying, you know, I say embrace the grind. Like it's, you got to embrace it or it'll eat you up. But maybe going in reverse order, the hardest thing I've had to do is combine a real estate picks and shovels company with an investment management company. Okay. Real estate folks, and it comes down to capital raise and distribution, all those type things. But most investment managers, you know, start out and they say, hey, we want to go build and we want to allocate to a group like Forum, like Jay Miller, our CIO, you know, Deutsche Bank, REIF would allocate to a group like ours. So we kind of started the opposite way where it was the picks and shovels. You know, we understand the cost of lumber, of insurance, of drywall, you know, all the way down, you know, to the studs of a building. Most investment managers start out going to raise money and allocate to people. I can't tell you how hard it has been and what two different cultures it is. And I'm our cultures are, like I interview people for culture, but to get to where we are, to have three strategies, to have one-off developments, and to have what I call kind of the Forum funnel where we are the experts in debt and private credit and equity and development. But it kind of evolved, like I said, after 2010. The high-level stats is we've done over 15,000 units to date. I think it's about $3.5 billion, you know, of AUM. But after the probably the next significant milestone after the GFC was COVID. And one of the things that COVID had taught us was people were moving. They finally had, you know, the guts in their life say, you know what, I've been thinking about, you know, moving to Denver, Colorado from New York City forever. I'm doing it. And they did, and it was permanent. And so U-Haul, among others, published, you know, one-way trips where people are moving. So it wasn't hard to see. And so we sold 26 assets, you know, seeing where people, you know, were moving to and from. And those 26 assets were assets where people were moving from. And we kept 17 existing assets plus all of our developments. We rolled that up into an open-end equity vehicle. So today, that equity vehicle has about 3,500-ish units. We've not been very active because the market for, you know, buying existing has not really been there in our minds. And then we launched those other two debt products. We have, you know, I mentioned debt product. We buy CMBS, SASB CMBS, and then we also have private multifamily debt in that vehicle as well. On the private credit side, again, we're a direct lender to multifamily owners, developers, and operators. So we're providing, you know, mostly debt these days where a developer gets a 50, 55% construction loan, and we might take them from 55, say, to 75. Now, our insurance policy is we are a developer, we are an owner. So if anything ever goes wrong, we can step in. So we get a lot of inbound calls from lenders saying, hey, we have a borrower, great long-term client. They just need a little bit of that bridge, you know, equity, you know, in the form of debt. And so really unique, I call again, called the Forum funnel. We also get the first look at buying those properties once they're built and stabilized because we've watched them. We've done all the construction draws and lo and behold, it gets built and stabilized. And so we, from time to time, will approach those owners and see if we can't buy those assets or partner with them on those as well. So
are you doing the lending on the private credit side out of the open-end fund, or is that a different vehicle that you're using?
So think about the open-end fund really as a participant in debt. So when there's a CMBS SASB, and SASB, for those who don't know, stands for single asset, single borrower. So it can be a single asset. I'll make it up. It's a large, you know, multifamily project in Denver, Colorado, or a single borrower. It could be a Blackstone who says, hey, we have 15 multifamily assets, you know, it's a $2.5 billion financing. So we're just investing higher up in the capital stack, like the double Bs, triple Bs, something like that. On the private side, our private credit, we are originating those loans directly. Our open-end debt fund might participate as kind of a passive participant in back, but the private credit team and our investments team operates, underwrites, services all those loans. So there is a distinction between those two.
So you got Forum Investment Management, or Forum, the business today. The composition of the investors that you have, I mean, you talked about some of your kind of your friends who helped put you in business, your parents and some of the early friends who helped kind of give you a start. But what is the composition of the investors in Forum today?
So still have those legacy investors that, you know, we're never going to forget about those people that got us to where we are. But we have an exclusive focus on registered investment advisors. So RIAs is the acronym. RIAs, you know, unlike the old days of, you know, investment advisor, the Smith Barney, where they were buying stocks and charging you commissions, they're fiduciaries. So they're looking out for their clients first. They typically get paid whatever their fee is, basis points, could be 100 basis, whatever that is, on the assets under management. So if assets go up and they perform well, they get paid. If they go down, so there's a true alignment. We're not focused on the institutions, the pensions, the endowments, and the like. Not for any specific reason outside of we relate more to those RIAs. We host 6 to 8 real estate symposiums in our home office where it's classroom style. We'll have them in, you know, the night before for dinner, meet, you know, I always say, welcome to our home. I want them to meet our accounts. I want them to really understand our DNA, who we are and what we stand for. And we do, you know, 3 hours the next day. It's not a product pitch. It's just basically, hey, here's real estate debt, credit, equity, development. Don't talk about returns, nothing like that. It's really to educate them because their end clients are our high net worth and family office folks that we grew up with, that we can really relate to and make a difference. So there are kind of 3 buckets for those that the thing about. You can go the high net worth family office, you can go the institutional, which we typically say, you know, pensions, endowments, sovereign funds. Then you have the banks and wirehouses like the Morgan Stanley's, you know, the UBS of the world. And so those are kind of the 3 avenues. And there's no right or wrong way for different groups. There was the right way for us. And it was just an evolution because although the RIAs take a lot longer to make decisions, they're a lot stickier too. They don't want to move money in and out. They're not getting paid a commission, you know, for selling their product. One of the last things, you have the broker dealers and IBDs. I kind of, you know, loop those groups together with the wirehouses.
So a lot of our listeners come from the very institutional world. So they're raising money from, you know, sovereign wealth funds, public pension plans, university endowments. Sometimes they're doing that through investment consultants who are also listening to the podcast, you know, who are advising their clients, who are the LPs. As you know, because the headlines are everywhere, private wealth and the rise of the individual investor and their ability to access private markets or alternatives, you know, you've got the big behemoths like the Apollos and the Blackstones that have been focused on this. And there's a lot of folks who are trying to cross over right now. And by crossover, I mean shift their business from being a, quote, institutional investment manager to targeting the RIAs. And I talk to these people all the time. And it's really, really hard. As somebody who's always been focused on this segment versus needing to transition, what advice might you have, or kind of what experience, learned experiences can you share about, you know, what works or what doesn't work when you're targeting the wealth advisor who has the client that's the individual high net worth investor?
Sure. You know, the wealth advisors, the RAs, there are more and more folks that are leaving, you know, the BDs, the wires, the like, going to, you know, more of an advisory, because you talked about earlier, you know, creating wealth. When you're one of these large shops, you know, it's their book, not yours. Whereas with on the RAA side, it's your book and there's real value you're creating, you know, as you move on in life or might want to sell a part or all of your business. There's ways to do that. But I would say it's not cheap. It takes a lot of patience. And there's the difference, and I've learned this not just about in distribution, but in hiring, is hiring people that have actually done it, not say they can or have participated in it. Doesn't matter what role. You know, just because you're a good, you know, football player doesn't mean you're a great coach or the like. Well, just because you're great in the capital raise of pension and endowments doesn't mean you have the relationships and the know-how, you know, in the RIA world. So it's expensive. It takes a lot of time to educate these folks. Our world in real estate is, in just investment management, you mentioned like trying more and more folks are trying to go to the retail world. Our investment world is over-productized. There are too many products out there. So the big keep getting big, and the little guys, for the most part, it's really hard to get noticed. And so when you go that route, it depends on where you're starting. Are you starting with $0 of AUM? Or are you starting? In our world, like when you have a fund, you typically need a 3-year track record and $100 million. And you're starting with the smaller RIAs because from a concentration limit, if I went to a $10 billion RIA and they said, hey, we're going to give you, you know, 3% of our book, you know, towards real estate, well, that's $300 million, you know? So you really have to start lower down the totem pole from an AUM size, assets under management with RIAs. What you sometimes get with those RIAs is they're just not sophisticated. They're like the mom and pops I had to educate. And so these advisors want to be educated about alts. They want to dip their toe in. And then as you get more and more AUM, it's easier to go up into the larger advisors. And some people say, hey, we want to see you at $500 million. And I've also learned, you know, that the first $100 million is the hardest to raise. And then once you get to 300, it goes to 900 quick, and 900 can go, and you can get bigger and bigger a lot quicker. But it's that the early years, those first 3 years, it's how are you positioning, you know, your product? And when I say product, I mean your investment strategies. They're not bought, they're sold. People, I think, also say, well, hey, I'm going to go do a closed-end fund that has a drawdown over 2 years. Well, an advisor that has 50 clients doesn't want to have to do capital calls 5 or 6 times over the next 2 years. They want to make one investment and be done. Now, pensions and endowments, because it's all their money that they're investing, they are the decision maker. They're okay doing. So structure is as important as the investment itself. Is it easy to access? Interval fund structures, point and click, right? But you have to have A, the product, B, you have to have a place to sell it. So one of the lessons learned is we had a real estate debt fund. Okay, well, that was our product. Well, now we have to have a place to sell it, which means you have to get onto Schwab and Fidelity. Well, you have to have the demand from advisors to get onto Schwab and Fidelity and Axos and LPL and. So hiring people that have actually done it and built it before, it takes time. It always costs more. It takes, you know, the story in life with any business, but you have to be willing to stick it out and really stay on those RAs and build those relationships. Because once they start allocating, it usually, and you perform, that continues to grow.
So I've always been curious on the talent side of things. When we talk about people who have done it before, people who have gone out, talked to and educated RIAs, raised the money, is that because they have the relationships and they can get in the door? Or is that because they have functional skills that are fundamentally different that enable them to go open the next door and kind of repeat a process that works for the RIA? What have you found works best inside of your shop?
I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a both and. You have to have folks that have good relationships. You have to have a good product. And you have to build trust and education to these advisors. Because again, these investments are not bought, they're sold. We have to sell them. We have to educate them. You know, forms, you know, there are a lot of folks out there that do 1031, 721s and the like. And a lot of advisors don't even know what a 1031 is yet. And there's a huge opportunity because growing AUM as a financial advisor is very tough. But if you have a client that has some appreciated asset, let's say they had a house in Vail, they've been thinking of selling that they haven't, it's $10 million for them. Well, there's $10 million of new AUM if they know about the different 1031, 721, you know, kind of UPREIT products that are out there. So again, education, it just takes time because I could have the best friend in the world that runs a $10 billion, you know, fund. He's the CIO. But if they don't need real estate equity or real estate debt, multifamily, or have a need or know us, if we don't have a track, they're not going to put their clients' money at risk with us. It doesn't matter how good of a relationship you have.
Yeah, super interesting. Let's talk about the kind of education piece as it ties to the investment products that you have and the markets that you serve. So you mentioned at the outset, you are exclusively multifamily, like very basic brass tacks. I mean, your investors are the, you know, your clients are the RIA and their underlying clients. How is multifamily kind of perceived relative to other asset classes, knowing that by and large, the kind of awareness bar around private markets and private real estate is pretty, pretty low. So kind of how do you think about multifamily as it fits into a portfolio? And then we could talk about some of the fundamentals and what you're excited about in the sector going forward.
Sure. So multifamily, I tell people, I said there are three necessities in life. It's food, water, and shelter. And I'm in the shelter business. So it's not an option to have a roof over your head because the next step was, you know, being homeless. So folks understand multifamily when you know, a lot of folks might have a single family home they rent out or a condo they rent out. So especially the athletes. Athletes love real estate advisors because they can see it, they can touch it, they understand it. And so look, we're not producing enough housing in the United States. The red tape, you know, that we get through municipalities to get building permits on top of higher rent, it's very, very tough today. And I think that the stat is roughly the difference across the U.S. between the monthly mortgage payment and the monthly rental payment is roughly around 40% higher for the monthly mortgage payment. Look, my folks helped me with the down payment when I bought my first house. And the difference is I was able to make the monthly mortgage payment. I just didn't have all the down payment. You fast forward today, the 10-year treasury is up 60 basis points, which is where long-term mortgage rates are for multifamily and single-family ownership. You know, not only do you need help with the down payment, now you need help with the monthly mortgage payment, but you can't afford that either. So all those things give a tailwind to multifamily rental. You also have a more transitory renter these days, you know, folks that like to move or like to spend certain amount of time seeing their kids at college or where their families are. So there are a lot of tailwinds for multifamily ownership as an asset class. And you also, as I mentioned earlier, you have twice as many lenders to multifamily, just given the government-backed agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, HUD. And one of the reasons, Brandon, why I focused on another reason on multifamily finance was it was so much easier to get those deals done. I don't think people fully appreciate when you have a retail center, you have to go, when you're doing a financing, you have to go to each tenant and get what's called an estoppel. They have to agree to all the terms they were in their lease. And then you have to go to and it was just easier to get a rent roll on multifamily, provide operating statements and underwrite those as well. And multifamily is a true inflation hedge when you think about it. And let me give you the difference between that and what I say is true commercial real estate. If I've got a 250-unit apartment building and 50 people move out next week, I can fill it back up the following week. I just need to drop my rents, okay? So as the market goes up with rents, the market goes down, I can move it. Things get overbuilt. When you're in a commercial lease, take the office building I'm in right now. We signed a 10-year lease, and our rental rate was $36 a square foot. Today, 2.5 years later, this market, it's probably one of the top office markets in the United States in Cherry Creek. You get $60 a foot. People are paying but there's no inflation. They can't come back to me and change my rent. I'm locked in. So as a landlord, I don't like that. I love multifamily because I'm a true inflation hedge. Well, what are the property types? Self-storage, you know, because those are changed monthly. Hotels, you change nightly, VRBO and the like, whereas office, industrial, kind of retail, you're really a static rent structure versus what I call a variable rent structure multifamily.
How does that message resonate with the RIAs? I mean, is that something that they're able to understand because it's so tangible? Like you said, I mean, it's kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, you have to have shelter. They understand how apartments work because most people have a mortgage or are familiar with one. I mean, is that, or just kind of what you explained to us, right? there. Is that the 101 level or is that the 501 level?
That's the 101 level because that's the macro about why multifamily, but that doesn't address the investment decision that an advisor has to make. And what's the best risk-adjusted return? If they could go get a 14%+ return in real estate debt or credit today, and they can go buy an existing multifamily property and have negative leverage, you know, you're buying in the 5, you know, cap rates today for anything decent, some sub 5 cap, and you're financing it at 6% or, you know, just under that, right around there today, you have negative leverage. So why would I take equity risk to go buy something today when I can go get that same or, you know, much better return in real estate debt, kind of sleep at night cushion there? Now, this is the first time in decades that we've seen, you know, let me just hit the pause button and give you a little difference between the 08 GFC crisis and today. Real estate, the number one thing you want to focus on in any real estate is what is my net operating income? What is my cash flow? Because that determines your value and can you, if you have debt, can you pay your mortgage? The thing about 08 is values crashed, interest rates crashed. Basically, we've been at a Fed funds rate, you know, in declining interest rate environment, and cap rates went down. Fast forwards over the last 2.5 years, when interest rates went up, values crashed, interest rates went up, but guess what? Cash flows have been solid and growing. Like our portfolio of multifamily through the first half of 2024 is up 3.5%. Yes, there's overbuilding in some markets, but we're seeing steady cash flow, unlike the GFC. So when you look at cash flow and values, my question to people would be, do you think cash flows are going to drop to meet these lower values, or do you think values are going to come back up to meet cash flows? We're kind of the home office view here is we believe values are going to come back up, you know, to meet those durable cash flows. That is the investment decision that advisors have to think about is, hey, we understand the story. You know, we love multifamily. We're in your real estate debt with you. The question then comes, well, when is the right time for multifamily equity? And I'll tell you, when the Fed dropped rates 50 basis points 3 weeks ago, the 10-year Treasury was roughly at 365 that Wednesday. The next day, it was at 374. I remember this because we had just locked in a 10-year loan on one of our developments, just sub 5%. Today, we're at 420. Okay, we're 60 basis points higher. So another fundamental thing that's an education for people is floating rate debt. SOFR, Fed funds rate, really affects the consumer, home equity lines of credit, you know, cars, things like that. And on the commercial real estate side, floating rate debt affects construction loans or value add, where they're doing variable rate, floating rate. The permanent home mortgage ownership and the permanent loan for commercial real estate is based off the 10-year treasury. So there's a difference. People are like, oh, rates are going down. Well, yeah, but for what? They're going up for permanent debt. And I think there were a lot of real estate owners and developers that have been kicking the can, and hoping that rates are going to go down. And now that they're up 60 basis points when Fed dropped, you know, 50 and SOFR's come down, I don't know, about the same, I think they're sitting there going, time's up. We're in real trouble. The difference again between 08 and today is, we're 95% occupied across the U.S. in multifamily real estate. These markets that were overbuilt are getting absorbed. It's just a matter of time. And then you compound that with, it's roughly the numbers we're seeing. We're going to probably end this year with 30%+ or -% of normal new construction starts. So new product is peaking this quarter, Q4 2024. In multifamily, we have the most deliveries in 3 decades. Yet we have the lowest number of new starts roughly in the same amount of time. What happens when there's one seat left, you know, on the United flight? The price goes up. Fast forward 24 to 36 months, what happens to rents? They go up. You have more and more demand where roughly 4.5 million housing units already, undersupplied. Rents are going to go up. It's inflationary. So it's educating those advisors you know, that now is the time. If you liked Apple computer stock at $100, do you like it better at 75 with growing cash flow? My answer is yes. You know, we put our money where I'm investing back on the equity side. And I'll stop after this last point. The 08 and on run for Forum was all about income first and growth second. What is our year one cash on cash? In 09, if we couldn't get a 12%+ year one cash on cash return, we were even looking at. Today, it's probably 5%. I think the mantra has flipped today. I think this decade's return on the equity investment of multifamily is going to be growth first and income second.
Yeah, I think that's a really provocative and relevant way to kind of wrap up this conversation. We could, you know, this has kind of been a masterclass in enablement and education, especially for our listeners who are trying to figure out kind of how you built what you did and really love the investment, the multifamily investment sector. For people who want to get in touch with you, want to learn more about Forum, you know, want to see deals, you know, what's the best way for them to learn more about the organization?
Sure. Yeah. They can go on our website. I think my email, phone number, everything is there. They can contact me. I'm all about partnership and long-term partnerships. You know, so I love to meet more people. We love to grow our business and share our solutions with them as well. So I appreciate that and happy, you know, to talk and help guide them and give them our, you know, house view as well.
Awesome, Darren. Well, I appreciate you joining me today. It's wonderful catching up. I'm looking forward to our next conversation already and seeing how kind of some of your views play out over the coming months and years, and really appreciate your insights and the time today.
Thanks, Brandon. Really appreciate being with you.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.